Near the end of the year in 2024, after more than 13 years of continuous warfare and more than 650,000 deaths, the Assad regime in Syria finally collapsed following a major renewed offensive that was launched by the Turkish-backed HTS faction. For Turkey, it was the culmination of more than a decade of careful strategy to remove Assad from power and to shift Syria to being within their own sphere of influence. Ever since the civil war next door first erupted in 2011, Syria became a maw of chaos that had saddled Turkey with a litany of problems that it could never easily solve. More than 3 million Syrian refugees fled the war and crossed the border over into Turkey, straining Turkish resources and inflaming anti-Arab, anti-refugee sentiments among the Turkish public, who grew increasingly resentful toward their presence. The US military came to support the Syrian Kurdish factions in their drive for autonomy within Syria since they proved willing and capable of defeating ISIS in the country. But in the process, they essentially created a de facto independent US-backed Kurdish statelet out of Syria's northeast, immediately on Turkey's southern border, inflaming the cause of Kurdish nationalism and separatism from southeastern Turkey as well, and providing the PKK Kurdish militant group with a safe base of operations to coordinate attacks in Turkey from. And as the war in Syria progressed, the Assad regime grew increasingly dependent upon the influence and support of Russia and Iran, two of Turkey's major regional and historical geopolitical rivals that it was loath to see gain the upper hand on their southern border. So all of a sudden, at the end of 2024, when rebels in Syria that had been backed by Turkey for years managed to overthrow the Assad regime and seize power for themselves, Turkey suddenly found themselves to be the primary power broker in the country and the new leading source of outside influence. Almost overnight, all of the problems that Syria had been causing Turkey over the past 13 years seemed like they would finally go away. Russian and Iranian influence in the country was crippled and replaced with their own influence in the halls of government. The millions of Syrian refugees still present in Turkey could finally be relocated back home in a major political victory. And most importantly of all, Turkey gained the leverage it had been seeking for years over the Kurdish PKK, whom it had been fighting a bloody insurgency against for decades. The PKK began its armed insurgency against the Turkish state in the late 1970s, initially seeking the full independence of the Kurdish-majority areas of southeastern Turkey and later modifying their demands for autonomy instead. Turkey always refused and fought them in a long, drawn-out, bloody war that cost tens of thousands of lives over decades, and morphed into Turkey's number one geopolitical security threat. By the time the Syrian Kurds established their US-backed proto-state across the border in Syria during the 2010s, the Turks considered the Syrian Kurdish government and the PKK to be essentially indistinguishable, meaning that they felt that they were dealing with a PKK-run statelet directly on their southern border that was coordinating and orchestrating the insurgency raging across the border within Turkey. So with the fall of Assad at the end of 2024 and the installment of a Turkish-backed militia into power, Turkey believed that they had finally gained the leverage in Syria that they needed to pressure the Syrian Kurds into surrendering their autonomy and removing the PKK threat from their border for good. And in a way, they were right. Merely months afterward, in May of 2025, the PKK announced that it would be fully dissolving and ending its armed struggle against Turkey in favor of political means instead, ending the long Kurdish insurgency in Turkey's favor and dramatically boosting the popularity for Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as he seeks an unprecedented fourth term in office ahead of the next Turkish presidential election in 2028. But as fate would have it, the removal of Assad from power in Syria was not just a major geopolitical bonanza for Turkey, but for Israel as well. Assad had closely aligned the Syrian state with Israel's greatest geopolitical enemy, Iran, and he had granted Syria's territory to the Iranians to use as a critical logistics corridor to funnel weapons and supplies through to Hezbollah in Lebanon. The toppling of Assad from power and the crippling of Iranian influence in the country eliminated this critical land bridge for Hezbollah, which on its own would have already been a major geopolitical victory for Israel. But Israel also didn't trust the rise to power in Syria of the Turkish-backed militant faction HTS and its leader, Ahmed al-Shara, either. Both HTS and al-Shara have radical Sunni Islamist and jihadist pasts. Al-Shara used to be a member of Al-Qaeda, while HTS was initially founded as Al-Qaeda's branch of operations in Syria before it split off into its own separate entity in 2017. Al-Shara himself has since publicly renounced jihadism and extremism, stating that he seeks no quarrel with anyone beyond Syria's own borders and that he especially seeks no confrontation with Israel. He has even repeatedly suggested that he is open to extending Syria's formal recognition of Israel under certain conditions. And yet, many within Israel's security establishment do not trust him or HTS anyway. Many of them believe that Al-Shara will say and promise anything right now in order to receive legitimacy and recognition and sanctions relief to improve the dire straits of the Syrian economy following more than 13 years of devastating total war and more than a half century of totalitarian and corrupt rule under the Assad family. They fear that after Syria's economic conditions improve over time, Al-Shara and HTS could revert back to their jihadist past and come to threaten Israel once again. And in the post-October 7th security environment, Israel is deeply mistrustful of anything that even remotely resembles jihadism on any of their borders. For many years leading up to the October 7th attack, the Israeli government generally regarded Hamas's leader, Yahya Sinwar, to be somewhat of a pragmatist whom they could work with. Sinwar had allowed Palestinians from Gaza to work across the border in Israel. He kept his distance from more radical Palestinian militant factions like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and he showed a willingness to negotiate and make compromises in the short term. And nonetheless, Sinwar still planned and executed the deadliest surprise attack on Israel that the country has ever experienced on October 7th of 2023. Since then, the Israeli government has become obsessed with establishing buffer zones around all of their borders in order to keep any other potential jihadist groups that would attack them away, even if it means blatantly violating international law and occupying more territory in foreign countries. It is why the Israelis invaded southern Lebanon in late 2024 and continue to occupy what they call five key strategic areas in the country to maintain a buffer against Hezbollah. And it's why they seized on the opportunity that the chaos in Syria gave them after Assad's fall with another invasion into Syria. Rather than wait around to see what would happen, the Israelis ultimately decided that they would prepare themselves for a hostile new government in Syria by preemptively carving out a sphere of influence in the south of the country while they had the chance to do so. The day after Assad fled the country, the Israeli military launched a limited ground invasion from the occupied Golan Heights and seized control over most of the UN-established buffer zone in the area between the Golan Heights and the rest of Syria, after the Syrian army had fled from the area. The Israeli Air Force then carried out a relentless bombing campaign all across Syria that hit hundreds of targets and crippled the new government's military capabilities, destroying its naval and air assets, eliminating their anti-air and heavy equipment, and wiping out whatever remained of the Assad regime's chemical weapons stockpiles. And then, the Israelis demanded the establishment of a new demilitarized zone in southern Syria south of Damascus that would be enforced by the Israeli Air Force with or without the consent of the new Syrian government, warning that any Syrian military assets that entered the south of the country would be interpreted as a threat and would be immediately attacked. Now, while Israel has attempted to present all of these moves that they made into Syria as being purely defensive, they seem anything but to both the new Syrian government and to Turkey. Turkey especially fears Israel's increasingly unrestrained attacks that they've been launching across the Middle East since October 7th, and also fears that Israel's ultimate objective in Syria is to shatter the country and undermine all of the gains they thought they had made with the PKK and the Kurdish insurgency issue. Since the October 7th attack in 2023, Israel has launched ground invasions into Lebanon and Syria and repeatedly bombed both countries. They've conducted large-scale bombing raids into both Yemen and Iran, and most importantly for Turkey's geopolitical calculations, they recently bombed Qatar as well, which shocked Turkey down to its very core. In early September of 2025, the Israeli Air Force carried out an airstrike on a Qatari government residential complex in the suburbs of the country's capital city, Doha. Israel said that the attack targeted senior Hamas leadership who were present in the building and who were actively taking part in negotiations for a ceasefire with the United States in the Gaza War. The attack failed in Israel's objective of killing the most senior Hamas leadership who were present, and instead reportedly resulted in the deaths of at least six people, five lower-ranking Hamas officials, and one Qatari security officer, along with four others who were wounded. The attack was unprecedented and shocking for multiple reasons. For one, Qatar has long served as a sort of neutral mediator in the many disputes of the Middle East, and has hosted negotiators from Hamas, Israel, and the United States for years, giving them all a place to meet and discuss in an environment that was considered to be safe and neutral for all parties present. But Israel's attack on the Hamas negotiators in Qatar has now permanently shattered that carefully cultivated image. On top of Iran's previous airstrikes that they attempted to launch at Qatar as well, only a few months previously. It marked the first time that Israel has directly attacked the territory of a Gulf Cooperation Council member. And perhaps most importantly, it marked the first time that Israel has directly attacked the territory of another country that is a close ally of the United States. Qatar is a major non-NATO ally of the US and hosts America's biggest airbase in the entire Middle East at Al Udeid. Nonetheless, the US did little, if anything, to prevent Israel from attacking Qatari territory anyway, and made no attempt to give Israel any real solid pushback afterwards outside of just condemning the attack. Qatar is also Turkey's greatest regional ally in the Middle East, too. And Turkey fears that if Israel was bold enough to strike Qatar's territory, they might be bold enough to strike their own territory as well. Israel has repeatedly accused Turkey of providing material assistance to Hamas for more than a decade now and of providing their leadership with a safe space to operate. Turkey has also never recognized Hamas as a terrorist organization, which the Israelis expected Turkey to do after they took the step of recognizing the PKK as a terrorist organization, but that never ended up happening. President Erdogan of Turkey has repeatedly praised Hamas and has repeatedly hosted senior Hamas officials on Turkish territory for diplomacy, despite Israel's accusations that Hamas has plotted and coordinated attacks on Israel from there. So after Israel's attack on Hamas members in Qatar, Turkey now fears that Israel might attack Hamas members on Turkish soil at some point in the future as well. And they also fear that their close relationship with the United States might not prevent it from happening either. Turkey is a member of the NATO military alliance. And so, an Israeli attack on Turkish territory targeting Hamas members could lead Turkey to attempting to trigger an Article 5 violation, bringing the rest of the alliance to bear on Israel. And after the US seemingly stepped aside and just allowed the Israelis to freely attack the territory of Qatar, a major non-NATO ally, Turkey now doubts the real resolve of America's willingness to keep Israel in check. And they fear that the US and NATO security guarantee matters less now when it comes to Israel than it ever has before. Basically, the Qatar attack and all of the previous Israeli attacks on Iran, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon have all shown to Turkey that they cannot rule out an Israeli attack on their territory happening at some point as well, especially if they continue hosting members of Hamas's senior leadership on their territory, which under Erdogan's presidency is likely. Turkey and Israel have a complicated historical relationship that used to be far friendlier than it is today. Turkey was the very first Muslim country in the world to recognize the Israeli state shortly after its founding in 1948, and both remained firm allies of the United States against the Soviet bloc throughout the entire Cold War era. Up until the 2020s, Turkey was one of only a handful of Muslim countries in the world to maintain its formal recognition of Israel, which gave the Israelis what was for a while a rare case of legitimacy within the Muslim world. In exchange, Israel greatly assisted the Turkish military by agreeing to share intelligence, to help out with their missile program, and to assist with modernizing the Turkish Air Force. Israel helped Turkey combat the PKK insurgency, and the Israelis helped arm and train Turkey's ally Azerbaijan in their successful wars against Armenia. Both Israel and Turkey maintained common enemies even after the end of the Cold War in Iran and Assadist Syria, which kept their cooperation steady. But then, across the 2000s and 2010s, as both Israel and Turkey grew more religious and less secular, their relations began to deteriorate. They rapidly plummeted after 2010, when the Israeli military raided and opened fire on a Turkish civilian vessel called the Mavi Marmara that was attempting to break through the Israeli enforced blockade of Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid. 10 Turkish civilians were killed by the Israeli fire, and dozens of others were wounded, which resulted in Turkey sharply downgrading its diplomatic relations with Israel. Turkey demanded an apology and compensation from Israel over the incident, which the Israelis refused, which led to Turkey suspending all of their military ties and cooperation with Israel. After that, Israel sought to recalibrate its geopolitical standing in the region to balance out the loss of Turkey as an ally. So Israel greatly expanded its military and diplomatic ties with Cyprus and Greece instead over the years that followed. Two of Turkey's most significant and bitter rivals who remain at odds over the contested division of Cyprus and their competing maritime claims in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean seas. Israel, Cyprus, and Greece all began conducting joint naval and air exercises with each other across the Eastern Mediterranean. And very recently, in September of 2025, it was even reported that the Israelis had delivered advanced anti-air defense systems to Cyprus as well. In tandem with Israel's advances in Assyria and its attack on Turkey's ally Qatar, it's not hard to see how Turkey interprets Israel's recent moves not as being defensive, but as an explicitly offensive encirclement strategy aimed at containing Turkey's freedom of navigation in tandem with Greece and Cyprus. And on top of everything else, Turkey knows that Israel is also less dependent upon them for recognition and legitimacy in the Muslim world than they used to be. As recently as 2020, only a handful of Muslim-majority countries still recognized Israel's legitimacy, including Turkey, Albania, Azerbaijan, the former Soviet Central Asian states, and Egypt and Jordan. But since then, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have all extended their formal recognitions of Israel as well, reducing Israel's need to continue relying on Turkey's recognition as a source for its legitimacy within the Muslim world, and further fraying what used to be the strong bonds holding them together. And the recent rhetoric between them hasn't been helping perceptions either. President Erdogan has repeatedly accused Israel of committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza since the current war began, and has led Turkey into joining South Africa's genocide case against Israel too. In March of 2025, during his Eid holiday address, Erdogan publicly asked God to destroy what he called Zionist Israel. And before then, in 2024, he announced a full ban on all Turkish trade with Israel. Meanwhile, on the Israeli side, some Israeli media outlets have begun referring to Turkey as the new Iran, while Netanyahu has vowed that he will prevent Turkey from restoring the historical Ottoman Empire. And in August of 2025, Netanyahu declared that he personally recognized the Armenian genocide of World War I as tensions with Turkey continued escalating, though the Israeli government itself has yet to take that step formally. Given all of these developments and Turkey's frequent hosting of Hamas's leadership, Israeli leaders fear Turkey's ultimate ambitions in Syria and the post-Assad world. Turkey, under Erdogan's leadership, has frequently attempted to spread political Islam across the region, and their deepest fear is that with Turkish-backed former jihadists in power in Syria, Turkey will eventually encourage them to begin hosting radical anti-Israel militants directly on their borders with the disputed Golan Heights. Though Turkey's own power is currently largely concentrated in the north of Syria, Turkey and Syria's new government have reportedly been pursuing a mutual defense pact, which, if realized, would extend Turkey's influence and power throughout the rest of the country down to Israel's own frontiers. Shortly after the Assad regime in Syria collapsed, Turkey was already scoping out potential new sites for military bases in the country in the Homs province and at the country's main airport in the Hama province, before Israel likely caught wind of that and then bombed both of the sites in order to prevent the Turkish military from ever being able to utilize them. For a long time now, going back decades, Israel has pursued a policy of keeping its larger and more powerful neighbors as divided and broken as possible in order to prevent them from ever being able to focus all of their resources together on Israel. And so Israel has frequently sought out alliances of convenience with many of the Middle East's religious and ethnic minorities in the process. Israel knows that a strong, united, and centralized Syria under Turkish and Islamist influences poses a much greater potential risk to their long-term security than a shattered or Balkanized Syria fighting against itself would. And so, Israel's recent advances and policies in Syria have been designed to do exactly that. And this is the core, fundamental, and irreconcilable difference in objectives in Syria between Israel and Turkey, because Turkey seeks the exact opposite outcome in Syria for their own better security interests. A Balkanized, decentralized, or weak central government in Syria is anathema to Turkey because of the Kurdish and PKK issue. If the Kurdish regions in Syria continue remaining autonomous from the central government or de facto independent, it'll continue being a safe haven for PKK-affiliated militants to operate from and a continued source of instability for the Kurdish-majority regions in southeastern Turkey, who might even revert back to a violent insurgency again in the name of their own autonomy with a model example of the autonomous or independent Kurdish proto-state right next door. Turkey believes that it must crush any hope of autonomy or independence for the Kurds in Syria in order to maintain their hold and authority over their own Kurdish-majority areas. And in order to do that, they have to resist Israel's pressure to keep Syria weak and divided at all costs. As recently as March of 2025, the most influential security policy think tank in Israel, the Institute for National Security Studies, published a paper that warned that the peace process between Turkey and the PKK ran contrary to Israeli interests. The paper argued that peace between the PKK and Turkey would weaken the ability of the Kurds in Syria to continue operating autonomously, which would enable Turkey to expand their influence south throughout the rest of Syria that would diminish Israel's freedom of action. In other words, Israel views the continued autonomy of the Kurds in Syria as a valuable buffer between themselves and Turkish influence spreading any further in Syria, while Turkey views the continued autonomy of the Syrian Kurds as a major security threat. In many ways, Syria is sort of like the Yugoslavia of the Middle East. It is a dramatically more diverse place than most outsiders and Westerners are aware of, which is why keeping the whole state together has been a monumental challenge for decades now. Pinpointing the exact diversity within Syria is difficult because there hasn't been an official census, including a question on religious affiliation within the country, since 1960. Nonetheless, before the outbreak of the civil war began in 2011, Syria's internal ethno-religious structure probably looked a little something like this. Sunni Muslim Arabs made up the majority of the population at between 55 to 60% of the total. But at just a little over half of the population, there were and remain substantial ethno-religious minorities in Syria as well. Another 10 to 12% of the population were Alawite Arabs, largely concentrated in Syria's two coastal provinces of Latakia and Tartus, where they make up local majorities. The beliefs and customs of the Alawites differ significantly from mainstream Islam in multiple ways, which has led to a significant degree of controversy over how exactly to categorize the Alawites. Unlike mainstream Muslims who believe in an afterlife in heaven or hell and in the absolute oneness of God, the Alawites generally believe in a system of reincarnation on Earth. They believe that God reveals himself as a divine trinity rather than as one, and they have no prohibition against the use of alcohol and maintain the use of wine in their rituals. The Alawites themselves consider their faith to be Islamic, but large swaths of both the Sunni and Shia mainstream reject this and consider the Alawites different enough to be an entirely separate religion altogether, including more radical groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Another 8 to 10% of the Syrian population were Sunni practicing Kurds. While the Kurds of Syria share the same religion as the Sunni Arab majority, they are also distinctly non-Arab and speak a very different, completely unrelated language with zero mutual intelligibility. They speak the Kurdish language, which is an Iranian Indo-European language similar to Persian, while the Arabs, of course, speak Arabic, which is a Semitic Afro-Asiatic language instead. The Kurds in Syria have historically been concentrated in the northeast of the country. Another 6 to 7% of Syria's population were Christian Arabs, and another 3% of the population were Druze Arabs. Unlike the Alawites, the Druze do not identify themselves as Muslims and openly present themselves as a wholly unique and distinct faith that is separate from Islam and every other world religion. The Druze number around 1 million people across the Levant region and are significant minorities in Lebanon and Israel, in addition to Syria. Roughly half of the Druze live in Syria, however, largely concentrated in the Suweida province in the south of the country, where they form the local majority. And in addition to all of these groups were smaller minorities of Sunni Turkmen and Circassians, Shia and Ismaili Muslim Arabs, Christian Assyrians, and Christian Armenians. So, yeah, Syria is very divided along ethno-religious lines more so than just about any other country in the Middle East is, with large areas around the peripheries that have local majorities of Alawites, Kurds, or Druze that are distinctly different from the Sunni Arab majority throughout the rest of the country. That's also interspersed with Christian, Turkmen, Circassian, and Assyrian minorities throughout as well. Throughout the civil war in Syria, the nominally secular Assad regime regularly claimed that its own totalitarianism and iron-fisted rule in Syria was the only thing keeping the country together and preventing the Islamists from genociding the country's various minorities. After Assad's fall from power, al-Shara and HTS declared their intent to keep Syria together in a strong, centralized state that would be fully inclusive for all Syrians regardless of faith or ethnicity. They immediately outright rejected any possibility of establishing a federal system within the country with autonomies granted to the country's various minorities, based on the belief that doing so would be a precursor to state collapse and the loss of their own power. Similar federal systems in other diverse countries in the Middle East have shown a pretty poor track record of success. Lebanon and Iraq immediately come to mind, and both are politically barely functional. But al-Sharas and HTS's Sunni Islamist and jihadist pasts and their refusal to consider a federal model has led to anxieties not only in Israel, but also within the various non-Sunni and non-Arab components of society within Syria as well. And as time has gone on, their anxieties have only worsened, and Israel's opportunities to influence them have only increased, all to Turkey's own terrible detriment. In March of 2025, Assad loyalists within the predominantly Alawite-majority areas on the Syrian coast launched a violent insurgency against the new Syrian government. Sunni Arab militia fighters, some of whom belong to HTS, responded with a brutal crackdown in the region that massacred at least 1,400 Alawite civilians in only a matter of days. In many recorded instances, they methodically went house to house in Alawite-majority towns and demanded to know their residents' sect before summarily executing them on the spot if they were Alawites before torching their homes. Al-Shara's government swore that it would hold the perpetrators of the massacre responsible and that the government did not condone what happened. A few arrests were made, but nobody has yet been formally charged or punished. While the new Syrian government's independent commission report controversially concluded that there wasn't any evidence that military leaders ordered the massacres to happen, which has been rejected by the Supreme Alawite Council that has called for a UN-supervised investigation to take place instead. Had this been the end of large-scale targeted violence against Syria's minority groups in the aftermath of the Assad regime, there might have been some chance at a belief that this was just a freak, one-off incident and that Syria could still overcome the odds and become strongly centralized again. But then, only a few months later, an even worse bout of violence exploded between the government and its Druze population in the southern Suweida province. In July of 2025, a group of Sunni Bedouins kidnapped a Druze vegetable merchant on a highway in the province. Druze militias then began carrying out reprisal attacks against the Bedouin community, which quickly spiraled out of control into vicious, full-scale fighting and massacres between the Druze and Bedouin militias in Suweida. The new HTS government in Syria accused the Druze in Suweida of resisting the central government's authority, and began deploying the army to march on Suweida to crush them and restore order. The army also began a blockade of the Suweida province and restricted access to roads leading into the territory and the entry of humanitarian aid convoys. And it was at this moment that Israel saw a major geopolitical opportunity arise. Israel itself has a substantial Druze minority population of its own. 150,000 Druze live within the Green Line borders of Israel who hold full Israeli citizenship, while another 25,000 non-citizen Druze live within the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. The Druze in Israel are deeply integrated within the Israeli state and are widely considered to be loyal subjects owing to their wide-scale participation in the Israeli military. And naturally, Israel's Druze population became incredibly concerned about the fate of their brethren across the border in Syria at this moment. Benjamin Netanyahu seized on the moment by declaring Israel to be the protector of the entire Druze community across international borders, and initiated an armed intervention across the border into Syria, asserting that the Syrian army had violated Israel's desired demilitarized zone in southern Syria and was involved in massacring the Druze. The Israeli Air Force began pounding advancing Syrian army columns moving into Suweida, and then, escalating things even further, they bombed the headquarters of the Syrian Defense Ministry in the capital Damascus and even bombed another area nearby to the presidential palace. Israel's intervention proved to be decisive, and forced the Syrian army to withdraw from Suweida in only a matter of days, and granted the Syrian Druze the ability to enforce a ceasefire on their own terms, retaining their de facto autonomy within Syria, confident of Israel's protection. After the dust had settled in Suweida, as many as 2,000 people there were dead, nearly half of whom were largely Druze civilians, and all over in only a matter of days. Israel, ironically, justified its intervention into Syria as a humanitarian mission to defend the Druze from violence, at the same time as they are also waging a genocidal campaign of total victory over Hamas in Gaza that has resulted in orders of magnitude more human suffering and misery. Geopolitics are always about interests first and humanitarian concerns second. And while they sometimes do overlap, Israel's real interest in intervening to defend the Druze in Syria was twofold. One, Israel is interested in maintaining its sphere of influence over southern Syria and in using the Syrian Druze as a proxy force of theirs to maintain a buffer against the Islamist government in Damascus and any encroaching Turkish influence. And second, Israel knows that their backing of the Druze's autonomy in Syria will further strengthen the hands of the other minorities in Syria to demand their own autonomies from the government as well, like the Alawites on the coast and the Kurds in the northeast. With the backing of Israel and the massive attack on their community that the government was powerless to stop, what incentive do the Syrian Druze have to follow al-Shara's vision of a strong centralized Syrian state? After the attack on their community earlier in March and seeing the attack on Druze and Israel's support for them, what incentive do the Alawites have to join in the system? And after witnessing the attacks on both the Druze and the Alawites, what incentive do the Kurds have to disarm and surrender their hard-fought autonomy in the northeast now? All of these communities will resist al-Shara's centralization attempts in Syria harder than they have ever done before now. And that fundamentally undermines Turkey's goals for Syria that include crushing the Syrian Kurds' autonomy. Israel and Turkey also both know that the U.S. is planning on withdrawing from Syria soon, and that for the moment, the Trump administration actually leans towards Turkey's plans for Syria over Israel's. During the 2024 campaign trail, Trump vowed that he would end America's decade-plus-long military presence in Syria that began in 2014 as an armed intervention against the spread of ISIS in the country, and then gradually expanded to include blocking the logistics corridor the Iranians were using to transport supplies to Hezbollah in Lebanon. But now that the new HTS government in Syria is staunchly anti-Iranian and ISIS has been largely contained, Trump feels that the US's work in Syria is done and that the job of continuing to contain ISIS would be best handled by a strong centralized government in Syria, which is why the Trump administration supports al-Shara and backs Turkey's vision for the country so strongly, even to the point of reportedly urging the Syrian Kurds to reintegrate with the central government in attempting to rein in Israel's operations there. But to Israel, it knows that the vast majority of the US military bases in Syria are found within the Kurdish-held areas in the northeast of the country, and that for years, those bases and the US military presence at them have been a major deterrent towards Turkey launching any further attacks on the Syrian Kurds. Without the bases and the US military presence, Israel fears that Turkey could take advantage of the power vacuum and extend its influence deeper into Syria at their own expense. And thus, Israel feels an even greater urgency to act rapidly in Syria to secure their own interests against Turkey first, like by intervening on behalf of the Druze and giving the Kurds more incentive to fight for their own continued autonomy. All of this, of course, has been an unmitigated disaster for Turkey's objectives in Syria, who fundamentally doesn't want to see the continued existence of a PKK-affiliated proto-state on its southern border. From Turkey's perspective, it's not hard to interpret Israel's attempts to keep Syria divided and the Kurds autonomous, and their attempt to sabotage the peace process with the PKK, and their expanding military cooperation and alliance with Cyprus and Greece, as all a grand Israeli strategy to encircle and contain Turkey on nearly all fronts in the Mediterranean, which risks jeopardizing Turkey's ability to continue relocating millions of Syrian refugees back home, risks reigniting the grueling insurgency against the PKK in the southeast, and risks compromising Erdogan's own ability to confidently secure another presidential re-election come 2028. And Turkey knows that it has few options at its disposal to respond with. If the Turkish army launches another ground invasion across the border into the Kurdish-held areas in the northeast of Syria, like they previously did three times in the late 2010s, but this time with the support of their HTS-backed client in Damascus in the name of re-establishing Syria's centralized authority, it will dramatically undermine the peace process with the PKK and inevitably set the insurgency back off again. And it'll probably force the Druze and the Alawite communities even further into the arms of Israel, and potentially reignite the whole civil war in Syria along ethno-religious lines once again. It'll also lead to the increased perception throughout the Arab world that Turkey is seeking to militarily dominate Syria, and that Turkey is potentially seeking out a long-term strategy of rebuilding the old Ottoman Empire again at the Arabs' expense, which is an image that Turkey has been taking great pains to try and avoid for a while now. It would also be cataclysmic for al-Shara's image with the Western world. Coming on the heels of the attacks on the Alawite and Druze communities, a major offensive into the Kurdish-held areas would shatter al-Shara's claims that he is seeking an inclusive Syria for all, and it would jeopardize his ability to receive sanctions relief and financial help from the West that he desperately needs in order to actually rebuild the country again. The only other option that's on the table for Turkey and Syria right now is potentially drawing closer to Russia, which continues to maintain its two major military bases in the country at Hamamim and Tartus, with substantial assets and troop numbers at each. Russia might even welcome Turkey's and al-Sharia's support in Syria in exchange for a guarantee on keeping their bases in the country active, while Turkey and al-Sharia would probably view the Russians as a useful buffer of their own against any further encroaching advances from the Israelis into the country, and another piece of useful leverage to try and use to force the Kurds with into giving up their autonomy without having to resort to what would inevitably become a very costly fight. But this option, too, is not without substantial risks that could blow up in their faces. For one thing, Russia and Israel have a fairly amicable relationship. Israel has a massive community of Jews from the ex-Soviet Union who emigrated to the country following the Soviet Union's collapse throughout the 1990s. About 1 million of them all in all. Russian is therefore the third most spoken language in Israel today by about 15% of the total population, and most of them still maintain close familial ties with their home countries like Russia, owing to how recently they emigrated. Israel itself has also been very careful to adopt a generally neutral position on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And both sides have historically been careful to avoid a direct confrontation with one another's forces in Syria. Russia does not want Israel, which has a major arms export industry, to begin opening up its floodgates of weapons and supplies to Ukraine by pissing them off in Syria. And Russia is also still so preoccupied with conquering land in Ukraine that they have repeatedly abandoned their other allies recently after they have come under attack. Russia stood aside and did nothing after Azerbaijan repeatedly attacked Armenia, despite Armenia having a mutual defense pact with Russia that they used to call for their support. Russia stood aside and watched HTS overrun the Assad regime at the end of 2024, despite the Assad regime being their ally in the region. And most critically, the Russians stood by and did nothing when Israel started bombing Iran over the summer of 2025, despite Iran being a major arms supplier to Russia for the war in Ukraine. Even worse, unlike Israel, the US, and the European Union, Russia has never once recognized the PKK as a terrorist organization either, has historically provided weapons and arms to the Syrian Kurds, and even allowed them to open up a representative office in Moscow. Moreover, Turkey and HTS deciding to draw closer to Russia carry similar risks as an invasion of the Kurdish-held Northeast does, namely, crashing their relations with the West. The US currently supports al-Sharia's and Turkey's vision of Syria, so long as it can be accomplished diplomatically without the help of the Russians. If they bring in the Russians, they risk losing America's diplomatic support for their vision, and they risk Washington throwing their weight behind Israel's vision of a federalized or even broken Syria instead. All of this is to say that Turkey has no easy options on how to proceed with what they want to see out of Syria right now. HTS and al-Sharia have no easy way to convince the Kurds, the Druze, or the Alawites to unite under a strong centralized government under their own rule. And Israel will continue seeking opportunities to pile on the pressure even further for what they want to see in Syria instead, like they did when they seized the UN buffer zone and bombed the Syrian military assets at the end of 2024, and when they aided the Druze maintain their autonomy over the summer of 2025. No matter how you look at it, Turkey and Israel are heading down the road towards a major confrontation over their diametrically opposed visions for Syria's future. And it risks becoming the next major conflict in the perennially troubled world of the 21st century Middle East. Interestingly, just before I released this video, the HTS-led Syrian government declared a ceasefire with the Kurdish-led SDF faction in the northeast of the country. It came after fighters belonging to the SDF attacked a Syrian government security checkpoint that resulted in the death of one Syrian security member and three injuries, along with sporadic bouts of violence elsewhere along the front lines between them and Syria. Meanwhile, 2 years now after the start of the war between Israel and Hamas that continues to rage in Gaza, reporting has begun coming in on how American views related to Israel and anti-Semitism have changed over this whole time. Left-leaning coverage of this has emphasized how American sympathy for Israel has declined beneath 50% since the start of the war and how support for Palestinians has increased to more than one-third, while portraying Israel's response in Gaza as an invasion that has gone too far. By contrast, right-leaning outlets have highlighted the unwavering U.S. support for Israel, have depicted Hamas's October 7th attack as a massacre driven by genocidal ambition, and de-emphasize opinion shifts that are happening within the American public. The way that public perception and narratives around ongoing conflicts and breaking news can become distorted by the biases of mainstream media is extremely important to understand today. And to help me stay on top of issues like this, I use this video's sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app on a mission to help you better understand the news you see every day. It works by pulling in thousands of articles every day from all around the world and organizing them by story. And then, for every story, they provide you with the key information you need, like political bias, historical reliability, and ownership structure of the sources reporting. All to help you understand why news outlets are saying what they're actually saying about something. But I think that the most fascinating feature of Ground News is Blind Spot, where you can see the major stories that people on the other side of the political aisle are seeing, but you're not. For example, in the context of the ongoing conflict in Gaza, the right is currently talking about an incident in London where a woman cut down ribbons in front of a synagogue that were commemorating the remaining 48 Israeli hostages still held by Hamas. While the left is talking about how Concordia University in Montreal, Canada, shut down all of their in-person classes in order to avoid planned Israel and Gaza-related protests that were scheduled to take place on campus. I genuinely believe that Ground News is a seriously useful tool in today's increasingly polarized media environment. I use it all the time myself for research whenever my videos touch on politically charged subjects, which are basically all of them. It's an extremely useful tool for gaining and understanding a nuanced view of the news. And you can get access right now for a whole 40% off when you scan the QR code here on your screen, click the button, or follow the link that's down below in the description at ground.news/reallifelore. You'll also be greatly helping to support my channel at the same time. So thank you if you sign up. And as always, thank you so much for watching.